Get up to the coasttocoastam.com website. Take a look at the Martian junkyard. Some of the pictures supplied to us by our guest tonight, Robert Morningstar. It'll be waiting for you, and we will too when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Morningstar is a civilian intelligence analyst, psychotherapist in the New York City area. He received a degree in psychology from Fordham University, an expert in Chinese language, history, martial arts. He is an FAA licensed pilot and instrument ground instructor, 23 plus years of flying experience. And here he is back on Coast to Coast. Robert, I've got lots to talk with you about. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here. It's really great.
Because of your flying experience, I got to get your general take on this missing Malaysian plane. What do you think's going on?
Well, you know, I think that I was watching General McInerney on the Hannity show tonight.
Yeah.
I think the plane is in Pakistan. And I looked at the route. If you believe that the Australians have found the wreckage and plot that point, the only conclusion that I can come to is that whoever stole the plane was heading straight for Antarctica. Well, what does that say to you?
What are they doing there?
Is it going to be in Antarctica or is it going to be in Pakistan? I believe General McInerney.
Yeah, Pakistan, all the way.
You know? But the other part is very intriguing, you know, because what if the guy was really, crazy and heading to Antarctica? And I said to my friend, are you going to believe that this Australian plot is the correct track? Where was the guy going? To Antarctica to meet with alien Nazis? You know? It's really a mystery. It's very fishy business is what I think.
Yeah, it is. And maybe we'll find out eventually, Robert.
Sure.
In the meantime, what have you been up to since we last spoke?
Well, a lot of things. I'm getting ready for my first conference outside New York in about 10 or 11 years. I'm going to go to San Francisco in June for the Secret Space Program and Breakaway Civilization Conference that is being sponsored by Joran von Staten. And you can go to secretspaceprogram.com to get the details. I'm very pleased, honored to be invited to this. Richard Dolan, Catherine Austin Fitz is going to be there.
Oh, heavyweights.
Dr. Carol Rosen will be addressing
Super.
Through Skype, and several other really, Joseph Farrell, Michael Stratton. And it's going to be a very, very good conference. These are all very competent, professional people. And I'm looking forward to meeting Catherine Austin Fitz.
She's a great girl, Robert. You really like her.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about her. And actually, her presence at the conference is one of the main reasons that I've chosen to attend this. I had actually hoped to be in England at Stonehenge, you know, with my Druid friend.
Well, you'll have a good time, and there's great information coming out of there.
Well, I've been doing a lot of work for this, you know. I mean, I've been doing a lot of work, as you know, on Mars, UFOs. It's an ongoing calling, vocation, profession, all of the above. I've written a very interesting article, pardon my saying so myself, but it's an important article. It's called the Dyatlov UFO Incident, which is a case of UFO mass murder of 9 Russian hikers in the Ural Mountains.
You know, I did a story initially with the writer of one of those books.
Was it Paul Stonehill?
Yeah, but he never told us what he thought happened.
Well, I'll tell you what I think happened. I think that here we have a clear case of UFOs stalking human beings. And then, in the middle of the night, attacking them. And it had witnesses of the light, the lightning, or the UFO activity. Do you know about the Marfa lights?
Yes.
Okay, the Marfa lights in Texas, the Native Americans have said that people who go out there to find out what the Marfa lights are have been attacked by the Marfa lights. They've been burned. They've been chased. Okay. Now, this incident in the Ural Mountains in 1959 has many aspects to that characteristic of the Marfa light, which is hostile activity to people who come near it. So this article, it's been working its way up for a couple of years. The first time I heard it from Paul Stonehill in a short video, it moved me deeply, you know, in a gut feeling, and I've been interested in it. Well, suddenly, what fell into my lap are the KGB files and the personal photographs and records regarding the incident that belonged to Yuri Gagarin, the first human being.
First human in space.
Yes. And it turns out that in this collection of official documents and artifacts, there was a photograph of the area where this happened. And I looked at it and I said, my God, this photograph was taken from outer space over the Kolatsiakil, where this mountain is really deadly. They call it now the Mountain of the Dead. The natives, Mashi tribes, called it the Mountain of the Dead because so many local natives had gone to the mountain and been killed. So they had that name, and they had another local name of the mountain, and in their language, the name of the mountain was called Don't Go There. That's pretty
appropriate.
Appropriate and a deterrent, you know?
The person I interviewed, by the way, was Donnie Icar, mm-hmm. who was a film director and producer, and he wrote a book about the pass. And then George Knapp, our colleague, interviewed Keith McCluskey. Mm-hmm. about that as well. So Stonehill, I have talked to him, though.
But Paul Stonehill broke the story.
Yes.
I'll tell you, he was the first one years ago to bring the story to my attention. And so I always associate it with him. And his book on Soviet UFOs, you know, UFOs in the Soviet Union.
That's right.
I think it's the definitive work so far. Well, this touched me in a human level. And when I saw the photographs in this collection of the victims, I realized what a terrible tragedy it was for the Russians, because these were really beautiful young people, all of them. They were young, intelligent. They were between 26 and 33, all intelligent, high-level students at a polytechnic institute in that area, which, by the way, is quite close to the Plesetsk Russian missile base, the launch sites, where they were sending the first astronaut going up. Let me say this. It's going to be a three-part series. I've discovered in the documents and in the photographs that the hikers, the victims, took two photographs. The last photograph taken by one of the victims was of the UFO.
Wow.
The luminous thing coming down out of the sky, down the mountain at them. But among the other photographs, unnoticed by anyone till now, was another daytime landscape photograph of the area and the mountain, Kolatsiakil, Mountain of the Dead. And I looked at it, and I said, what an interesting mountain. You know, what an interesting place. It's not a steep mountain. It's very gentle slope up and gentle slope down, kind of symmetrical, like a mound, a giant mound. And then I looked, it's got a bald spot on the mountain. And I thought, when we cut out segments of a forest to build a ski run.
Yeah, same kind of thing.
Right? You know, the whole mountain is covered and so, but you see the naked spot there. Well, I looked there, I said, a naked spot on the mountain. I went on. And then I was reading the document about the recoveries. And it said that the last bodies were found under 4 meters of snow. That's 12 feet of snow.
And it wasn't an avalanche either, was it?
Right, and it wasn't. It's an area that's not known for avalanches. So I said, wait a second. Bald spot on a mountain, 12 feet of snow? Let me go look at that picture. So bring up the picture, and I improve the quality of the lighting. You know, it was kind of a dark picture because I've developed a very interesting skill out of necessity that these videos, YouTube videos, like some of the things that I've captured for the Dyatlov, that came from a video book by a man named Romalko. But they flash these pictures really fast, you know, like one per second.
Like subliminal type.
And so I have this really tedious job of having to run it back and find exactly the same the frame I want.
Frame by frame.
But I grab my camera, digital camera, and I've gotten a really pretty good handle on shooting off the monitor, either my 21-inch monitor or my 42-inch monitor. And the thing is that the digital camera is more sensitive than our eyes, and the projection with backlighting projects more information that our normal human eyes can't pick up, but my digital camera does. So then I enhance that one level up, like I did with this mountain photograph that's going to come out in UFO Digest, and lo and behold, the bald spot on the mountain is a UFO that's approaching them at a distance as if observing them. And my interpretation is that I have found two photographs of a UFO that was stalking this group of Russian hikers.
What a great story.
Down on them.
They were petrified. Something happened to them, Robert, in the wee hours.
On the moon.
They tore their tent apart, everything.
Yeah, well, they tore them inside and out apart. I have x-rays. I mean, the details in this collection, and I'm really honored, honestly. I'm really honored to be the person who received this and who's giving it to the world, because this is the legacy of Yuri Gagarin, and it puts in context the real reason for his spaceflight was a military reason. Yes, the propaganda thing was really big and important, you know.
Right. And they wanted to beat us.
But there was a really important military aspect to this, and with this little bit of detective work that's happened to me, you know, detective work happens, you do it, but sometimes a thing happens to you. I've discovered an amazing thing. The Gagarin's launch came and just in the area north of Moscow. It had a very strange orbit. It went up to the northeast and over like a diagonal orbit of the world, and then came up from below across Africa and then back up more or less to where it began, but a little less. But where the other thing is, Gagarin didn't land in the space capsule. They didn't trust the space capsule to land safely. They thought he might be killed. So Gagarin flies around the Earth in an hour and 48 minutes, and they tell him to jump out of the space capsule on the way down.
I didn't know that.
No. Well, this is what happened.
He parachuted down himself?
He blew the hatch at 23,000 feet, and he parachuted down. But get this. I'm shocked.
What happened?
He parachuted down in and over that general area where this mountain is.
Wow.
So the photograph that's in this current issue of UFO Digest shows how important this event was to the Russian military, that they put it on. Imagine the first human spaceflight in history, and they put this on the book. Take picture of Kolyat-Soryat Sakil on the way down, right? So I think this is a very big story.
And when are you going to be ready with that?
Well, the first part is already out. It's on UFO Digest right now. It's called The Dyatlov UFO Incident, A Case of UFO Mass Murder in the Ural Mountains, Russia. It's Ural Mountains.
All right. How about the all three of the parts? How long will it take?
I think one a week.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I'd love to talk with you about that when they're all out.
Oh, sure. We certainly will cover that.
You sent us, by the way, some incredible pictures of Mars.
Yes.
We've got them posted on the website. Tell me a little bit about these, Robert.
Well, you know, I've been studying Mars for a very, very long time. And I'm always seeking. People are always sharing. And sometimes just, as they say, out of the blue, serendipity, or God works through Google is my new saying. You know how that algorithm works? That it reads everything you're interested in the past. And a lot of people think this is bad. But I don't think it's so bad because of the things that have happened to me as a result of that web bot algorithm. Or it just drops into my lap the most amazing things, you know? So I was interested in the Dyatlov incident, and I went to some site that had Dyatlov, and then I saw this thing that said Yuri Gagarin's secret KGB files on the Dyatlov incident. So I run it, and then I shot it. Similarly, I get an email that has something about the Curiosity rover going around Mars, and there was this panoramic view of this place called the Dingo Gap. So, of course, new material on Mars, I'm always ready. So I get in there, and this is a very, very, really cool program. It's on my Facebook page if anyone's interested. Just scroll down and you'll see it, panoramic view, Dingo Gap. And so I start running this thing, and the great thing about it is the simulation is you can turn it and aim it, zoom in, zoom out, and it's almost as if you're walking around on the place. So I start looking, and I go, wow, what's that? I mean, literally, from a mile away, this one stone stood out on one of the slopes. I said, what the heck is that?
It looks like a rolled up piece of sod, doesn't it?
No, that's the astroturf.
Yeah.
But no, this is another rock that I haven't shown yet. And it's a hollowed out stone that has a triangular form carved into it, hewn out of stone. So I start exploring that area. Then I start finding more and more what I would describe as stone boxes, literally right angle cornered, leveled stone boxes. Others box-like forms with perforations on the side that are all equidistant from each other, almost as if they were holes for rivets and bolts.
Wow.
But then the stones themselves, just the geometry of these stones, like the one that the first one on the website, that is an amazing object.
I think we've crashed your website, by the way.
Crashed it?
Already.
Oh, well,
it'll come back.
I hope so.
It'll come back.
People are, I'm really proud of these pictures. So I went through this with this program, and I kept looking at different places in this 360-degree panorama, zooming in. And let me ask a question. Remember how dead Mars was 10 years ago, 11 years ago, dry as a bone?
It was supposed to be.
Right. The sky was some murky, weird color. Why does Mars suddenly look like Arizona to me?
I know.
Yeah. Why does it look like New Mexico? You know?
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, they've been fudging the data on Mars since, I guess since the day Richard Hoagland said, hey, isn't that the face on Mars? But it's actually NASA who named the face on Mars, you know? And then they have to bend over backwards to debunk their own inference, which is exactly what it was.
And then other scientists jumped aboard, Molinar, DiPietro, and
yeah, they did good work, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Molinar and DiPietro finding the second picture, because NASA lied to everyone after the first day. They called, oh, look, there's a face. And they said, well, is that real? And they said, well, we'll be able to tell when we come around and take another picture. And then they came around, they took another picture, and then they said, oh, no, that was just an illusion caused by lights and shadows, but they didn't show the picture. So then DiPietro and Molinar found the second picture and did the comparisons, and there it is.
Okay, hold on for a second, Robert. We're going to come back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robert Morningstar with us. Robert's website, UFODigest.com. And, of course, he's got his Facebook. That you can you get to it from UFO Digest, Robert?
I don't think we have a direct link to my Facebook from UFO Digest. But if you go to Facebook and type in Robert Morningstar, look for the head of the dolphin.
There you go.
I see.
But tell me about your fascination with Mars.
Well, who isn't fascinated with Mars? But mine started back in 1956 when I saw The Thing from outer space, you know?
Yeah, great movie.
Because, you know, there was in the beginning when they find the saucer, the reporter's going a little bit nuts, excited, and he goes, this could come from Mars. like 50 million miles away. And that was, wow, Mars. That put the idea in my head of this little thing so far away that it was, seemed impossible then that we would ever really get there or even see it. And then growing up, the same years, you know, 1956 to 58, Flash Gordon, Captain Video was on, and those serials gave me the inspiration to look to outer space and those kinds of adventures. And there was a film called Flash Gordon's Trip to Mars, and where he meets the Queen of Mars and so on. So Buster Crabb was a very big icon, a hero, you know, for me as a kid. Living in a tenement in New York, it was very, very a wonderful leap of imagination to travel to the moon or Mars with Flash Gordon, especially a person like Buster Crabb, who was, well, the embodiment of an American Olympic ideal. He was an Olympic champion. So he had it all. People don't know that his first role was as Tarzan, and that's a, it's a quite a good Tarzan as well. So then in 58, John F. Kennedy came out along, and he was kind of like a real Flash Gordon type in real life and another hero. And, of course, he got elected, and the rest is history. We would never have gotten to the moon if...
He had an ambitious goal, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. You know, I, honestly, I really do believe that JFK, let me put it this way, I think JFK ran home after the Congress in those years so he could see Flash Gordon again, as he had seen him as he was growing up, because he saw Flash Gordon in the 30s in the first-run theaters, you know? And so I think that that was in the back of his mind, too. And the resurgence of Flash Gordon in the 1950s, when television revived and reanimated so many careers, all these past movie stars and icons of the 30s were... So you see, a person like me or you and I, growing up in the atomic age, we have absorbed much more of American culture through television. We got the download from... You know, the silent movies to then and from then on. So we carry a lot within us. And one of the things I carry personally, and I'll tell you honestly, I try to live up to it, is a Flash Gordon image. If you want to know who one of my alter egos is.
It's Flash Gordon.
Yes, absolutely. That's why I learned to fly. I learned to fly because I was interested in UFOs. I was interested in space. And I was interested in possibly seeing UFOs from a plane, and it happened to me. And I wrote an article that I recommend to people. It's called Two Eggs on a Roll, No Beacon, and it's about two egg-shaped UFOs that went right by the nose of my plane back in 1990 as I was flying over Long Island at the Northport Stacks. You know the Northport?
I do.
Yeah, well, Northport and Port Jefferson are reporting points for pilots in that area, because they're so recognizable. There are big power plants there, and these four giant stacks, hundreds of feet high, are there. So I was flying there and on a solo flight to Albany on my way, and all of a sudden I look out the left side, and in the distance below me and moving fast, I see some traffic. That's what we call airplanes that we think are approaching. So I told air traffic control at MacArthur Airport, I have some traffic at my 10 o'clock. And they said, well, we don't see them on radar. And I said, well, they're climbing, and they're going to pass me. And I was at about, I can't remember exactly, I was at 1,800 feet climbing to 2,000. I'd just taken off. And so I see, and I said, they're approaching my altitude, reporting that. And then he said, we still don't see them. Sometimes they're too low for us to see them.
Pick up, sure.
Yeah, well, I had a transponder. I'm a small plane, and I'm sure they could see me, but they couldn't see them. So these two things go by me, I swear, 100 feet. You know, I'm moving forward. I crossed them in a T, right? They were climbing, and when they saw me, they accelerated to pass me before we collided, or just they kept speeding up. When they went by me, I saw two eggs with a small cupola on top, and I blinked and looked for propeller,
nothing,
rudder, wings. As cheese out of my two glass hairs. Now, here's the other thing. They were so tight in unison. They were two separate objects, but they were locked in something that looked like...
Like a force field?
A force field, but like a toe. Do you know what I mean? Like a tow line?
Yeah.
They were so in sync that they never deviated. They didn't rise. If they rose, they both rose. If they accelerated, they both accelerated. There was no lag.
It was almost like they were connected.
Exactly. And then, so they went past my nose. I went past their tail. As they went by, I went by, and I looked, and they looked like eggs from behind as well. Like, what I thought of was two America's Cup yachts without keels joined at the hulls, one upside down and the other one right. You know,
and speeding at an incredible rate, no doubt.
Oh, and then they took off. I mean, they were accelerating. You know, they were moving kind of slow at first. It took about 7 to 10 seconds for them to climb up to my altitude. But when we were approaching, they zipped. And they crossed Long Island Sound toward Bridgeport in about 7 to 10 seconds. They were gone into the haze. So that was really quite an experience. I had no magnetic anomalies, no engine problems. I didn't feel any buffeting from wind or air waves. It was, and I was fine. So they're gone, and I just had to. I was completing my solo. A solo flight that I needed to qualify for my test.
This was the flight for you?
It was one of the qualifications before I got my license, so well, very nice.
Was that the first time you were up as a pilot by yourself?
No, I had been up before, but okay. You have to do three solos in the regimen. There's a short solo and then a long cross-country solo.
What's it like the first time to fly by yourself?
It's very exciting because the flight instructor will take you by surprise. You know, the flight instructors are sizing you up. And I had a lot of them, you know, because they don't stay. Flight instructors get their hours, go into commercial flying and so on. So I had a lot of great teachers. Actually, my first flight instructor was the former chief pilot at Grumman Aviation. His name was Joe Gallia. He was a legend, a test pilot in the 40s and the 50s.
Like a Jaeger.
Well, that same era. And you know what? I watched the History Channel when they have these shows about Grumman Aviation.
Yeah, yeah.
And there he is in the background, young man going around in the hangars.
Small world.
So anyway, what's it like? It surprises you when you do the landings one day when you're practicing, and then you land, and the instructor says, "Okay, meet me over at. I'm going to go for coffee. Meet me over there at the restaurant," and he gives you the plane, and then you go up. And I had a very exciting first complete solo. It was at Brookhaven Airport, and I had a very funny kind of Jonathan Livingston Seagull experience on my first
That's
come around.
It's funny you say that. Just had Richard Bach on the air.
Really? Oh, man. Richard Bach is like a soul brother to me.
Yeah.
We can talk about that book and how it moves other people's lives another time. But So here I go. I take off, and then I'm coming around. Once around the traffic pattern, and I'm going the downwind, and then I turn the crosswind. And when I turn the crosswind, there were three seagulls in my way, off to my left, and then I'm flying along, and then I start my turn. I'm flying along with the three seagulls, and I'm wondering that I really don't want to mess them up. And when I thought that thought, one seagull looked at me over his shoulder, then he looked forward, and then they banked his wings, and they all banked at the same time. And I said, something said to me, just bank your wings at the same angle as the seagulls and you're going to make it. So I did that. And we all flew. They flew on an inside and flew away. And then I came in and did the landing. And that was cool. Then I went and did two more. And on the second one, I was a little too excited. And I hit an air pocket coming in short.
With a little plane. Not good.
Yeah, the Cessna. Yeah, it was a Cessna 172, I believe. And so I'm coming in, And you know those chevrons at the front? They're like arrows that point to the runway, and then you see the number.
With the little thing blowing, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there are three like sergeant stripes for people who don't know what chevrons are. Three of them are pointing at the runway, and then the numbers. Well, that's that area where the chevrons are. That's supposed to be don't land here. This is only for takeoff. But I hit an air pocket, and the plane starts dropping like a rock. And that's when people get killed because they freak out. So I decided not to try to adjust. But when it came to touchdown, I gave it full power with full flaps, so I had a downwash. But I still hit hard and on the chevrons, and the plane bounced, boing, and then it bounced on the numbers, boing. And then it was losing airspeed. And then I got into ground effect. That means when the air is moving from the propeller is moving under the plane and washing down with the flaps, it creates a fake lift because you're being pushed by a cushion of air from below. You're not being lifted by the wing. So I do boing, boing on the numbers and then decide not to do the roll. I'm just going to climb out and do a go-around. So I give it full power, and I tell you, that was the longest moment. It was eternity as I'm watching the airspeed crawl slowly, and I'm gliding over the runway and slowly waiting for the critical speed at which you can then fly. If you don't hit something like 56 knots,
you can't pull it up.
You can't really get up there. But in ground effect, you're off the ground, right? Because the cushion, if you lose that cushion, you're gone. So anyway, it came around, and I went around and did it a couple of times, and it was great. So I encourage everyone, if you can, to learn to fly. Man has wanted to fly for a million years, and that's what got me to get flying. You know, I've been a space cadet.
I think that's helped you in your Mars research, hasn't it? Your flying ability?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The navigation. You know, a while ago, I started working on a book that would be to teach people how to navigate Mars and with landmarks and directions. And the compass is a fundamental tool of survival and navigation, all the things. See, the thing about flying that is really great is that it integrates many, many skills, multitasking, you might call it. You have to know weather. You have to know radio communications. You have to know the mechanics of an engine. You have to know aerodynamics, control surfaces, winds, wind corrections, air density.
Oh, you've got to be a computer.
Oh, right, but it's a beautiful thing. If you have an interest in science, I think aviation is the thing that pulls all the sciences together. It requires all of them of you, and it's a very good feeling to achieve it. So I went to see The Right Stuff, and I'm sitting there watching Chuck Yeager and the astronauts being depicted by actors, and they did a wonderful job. It's an inspiring movie. So I go see it a second time, and this voice said to me, "Robert, what are you doing here sitting paying $7.50 a shot to see an actor play a pilot? You're a pilot. Get your license." And getting a license in New York City is not a very easy thing.
Really? Why?
Well, airports are far away. Everything is very expensive. Aviation is in the New York area. The costs of the travel, the time,
expensive.
The instructor, the airplane, all of it. But it was a goal. And so I learned to fly at MacArthur Airport, at Mid-County Flyers. And I thank all my wonderful flight instructors out there and the ones at Caldwell, especially the Norwegians. They're really cool pilots. In Caldwell, I flew with a lot of Europeans, and they were really competent pilots.
So how do you equate the anomalies with Mars with the things that you've been working on? How did you pinpoint
that? Well, that's an interesting word. How do I equate? It's all part of the equation. You know, we're all trying to find out why we're here. You know, why are we on this?
And how do we get here?
How do we get here? If we don't know those answers, we're really not in a good position to determine where we're going. Because if you don't know where you came from, you really got to...
You don't know where you're going. You're right.
Well, how can you be sure?
That's right.
Well, what I'm trying to do is help people make a jump in consciousness and awareness and make them realize the universe is really simple and not difficult to understand if you have good information. And good information has been kept from us. On August 27th, 28th, and 29th, when Mars was closest to the Earth in 60,000 years, I had the privilege, I worked really hard for it, of getting a really high-quality telescope with a super plausible lens, and I was able to see Mars with 128x magnification.
That's huge. No, I see it with a 20x.
Yeah, well, that,
what a
that
difference.
Was... It was only 34,600,000 miles away, and it can be as far as 52. So I knew that I had to see it, you know? And my best buddy, Alan, had moved out of New York City with his telescope. I'd been on the roof for over 20 years. Let me see, in 2003. Yeah, it was 20 years or so, 19, that my buddy Alan and I had gone. We had this observatory on the 24th story of a building here on the west side.
Can you really see, though, with city lights all over the place there?
Really, honestly, yes. We saw a lot. We could see all the planets. I saw the Ring Nebula, the shoulder stars of Orion, the rings of Saturn.
That's fascinating.
Fascinating. It's just the, you know what it really is? New York in winter is a really great place. If you have a clear night and the cold air, it's crystal clear.
Yeah.
So Alan and I would go on the roof, and Alan would bring a little bottle of tequila, and we'd...
Don't fall off the roof.
No. That happened almost, but not for... It almost happened once, but not from tequila. We never drank that much. But he and I really became competent amateur astronomers together and got lunar charts, and I can navigate the moon. One of my favorite things is teaching people how to navigate the moon. So that's how flying and all of this came together. Now, on August 27th, 2003, I was on my rooftop from 12:30 to 2:30 in the morning.
All right, we're going to pick that story up when we come right back, Robert, and find out a little bit more about these Mars anomalies. Go take a look at some of the pictures at coasttocoastam.com.